around the world with reporters.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change. But as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Homal Izgi, Vienna.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day, on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Oh.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdel Salam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing out the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government's support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states.
In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
A Yemen Nasrallah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S., which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Nasrallah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
The accusation of the U.S. State Department against the Ansarullah movement is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the U.S. is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the U.S. for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The U.S. State Department is not in a position to accuse Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of associations of Palestinians from across Italy jointly organized a demonstration in solidarity with the people of Palestine. A large crowd flooded in Rome's iconic San Giovanni Square to hold a rally dubbed Stop the Occupation, Free Palestine, Jerusalem or Quds is our capital. Protesters held banners and placards reading Stop the War and Sanctions on Israel.
Politicians, trade union members, anti-war campaigners, people from all walks of life have joined the demonstration demanding justice for Palestinians. They are calling on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I think it is a matter of political opportunism. That's why Italy's support to Palestine has been shifting towards positions inconsistent with those held in the past. There is also a lack of commitment on the part of the moderate political forces that used to hold a balanced stance on the conflict. The rise of right-wing parties and their alignment with Netanyahu's government has changed the dynamics entirely.
Unfortunately, we know full well how economic interests play a crucial role in foreign policy. But we have some good news finally, as on June 2nd, the European Trade Union Confederation issued a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Also, working movements are shifting towards pro-Palestinian positions.
Protesters also called on EU member states to impose sanctions on Israel to put an end to what they called a flagrant violation of international law taking place in Palestine. Tens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have been held across Italy in recent days. About 2 weeks ago, pro-Palestine groups staged protests at the Rai national broadcaster headquarters and branches in several Italian cities, complaining that the persecution of Palestinians has been sugar-coated in Israel's favor by the public television company. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of British pro-Palestine activists amassed outside a notorious arms manufacturer near Blackburn on Friday, demanding an end to Israeli arms sales. Anger was vented in various ways, including with a funeral procession honoring the recent martyrdom of over 60 children slain in Gaza.
It's a genocide that's occurring before our eyes. Companies like BAE Systems are complicit in what's going on there. They're providing illegal weaponry.
Now they've been exposed, the Zionist regime, because from footage from underground, from Gaza, has come out. And people are starting to realize that this is an apartheid, ethnic cleansing, colonialism, regime that is operating, and it has to end.
Today, we came here to send a message to the world. What is the mistake of these children? 64 children have been killed, innocent. Some of them were sleeping in the hands of their parents, and they found themselves dead. Why? One, the answer is occupation. In the occupation, everything will be sorted out.
BAE Systems is one of Britain's biggest arms dealers and is known for building weapons used by Middle Eastern regimes to target innocent civilians in conflict zones.
Essentially here to register our protest and say to BAE Systems and to the government that this is simply unacceptable, that weapons manufactured here in Lancashire, here in England, should be used against civilians in Gaza and in Palestine.
This is the second week that local residents have come in good numbers to condemn BAE Systems, and more action is being planned. Major arms firms such as this have been heavily criticized many times in the past. However, it's very rare for protest movements of this size and frequency to engage in such regular and very direct action. Now, these locals are coming out in numbers, hoping to force a change which will inevitably save lives in places like Palestine and elsewhere too. Robert Carter, Blackburn.
With only less than 2 weeks to go before Iran's presidential elections, the seven candidates have expressed their views and plans in conferences, TV programs, and interviews. Some have criticized the current economic policies, while others pledged to make some fundamental reforms if elected. Mohsen Mehralizadeh said he would seek de-escalation between Iran and other countries, noting that the government should not let for some factors to detach the country from the rest of the world. He also pledged to form a cabinet made of experienced people who are able to solve people's problems. Ebrahim Raisi pledged to do his utmost to end the corruption in the country. He also pointed out the issue of unemployment as a major problem young Iranians are struggling with. He vowed to help the youth with their employment and housing problems. Raisi stressed that his first priority would be people's livelihoods and welfare. Alireza Zakani, who is currently serving as a parliament member, said he would seek a comprehensive progress of the country. He also criticized Iran's current foreign policy and stressed that the country's foreign policy should serve the economy, culture, society, politics, and security by taking a broader horizon into consideration. Former central bank governor Abdel Nasser Himmati said he is a reformist and his main agenda is economic reforms. He called on Iranians to support him with their votes. Himmati noted the mass COVID-19 vaccination would be his first plan after winning the race. Another candidate, Amir Hossein Qazizadeh Hashemi, said his main goal is to support the people by reducing household expenses and increasing purchasing power. He also pledged to eliminate economic rent-seeking and lessen the government's interference in the process of production, imports, and distribution of goods. Former top nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili called for a strategy in which people can observe and monitor the performance of the government. However, he called on Iranian people not to wait for anyone and continue their efforts towards the development of the country, regardless of who is going to win the presidential race. Mohsen Rezaei criticized former and current administrations for adopting wrong economic policies. Rezaei said such measures have caused economic hardships Iranians have been dealing with for years. The 66-year-old hopeful also called for unity among Iranians in order to be able to overcome the economic crisis.
Squalid accommodation that was not fit to house human beings fleeing persecution. That was how lawyers representing six asylum seekers described Napier military barracks in Kent in a case brought to the British High Court. In a landmark ruling, Mr. Justice Lyndon agreed and said all of them were vulnerable victims of trafficking and or torture who experienced a deterioration in their mental health as a result of their accommodation at Napier Barracks.
Napier Barracks has turned into a resident site for vulnerable asylum seekers despite a warning from Public Health England that the dormitories were not suitable accommodation during a pandemic. However, the court found that this advice was not followed, leading to a COVID outbreak infecting half the residents.
The Home Office responded to the ruling with this statement.
Throughout this period, our accommodation providers and subcontractors have made improvements to the site and continue to do so. It is disappointing that this judgment was reached on the basis of the site prior to the significant improvement works which have taken place in difficult circumstances. Napier will continue to operate and provide safe and secure accommodation. We will carefully consider the ruling and our next steps.
Human rights campaigner Adam Yassir came to the UK as a refugee from Darfur in Sudan. He's been supporting asylum seekers who've been staying at Napier Barracks and gave a witness testimony to the High Court.
Multiple asylum seekers asked me to provide a noise cancellation earplugs, and I asked, and they say, the guys say to me, some people scream at night, they've got PTSD.
Calls are mounting for the Home Office to shut down the controversial barracks after a damning court ruling found that they had acted unlawfully and irrationally, which could potentially lead to damages against the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel.
They felt they need to, they've been used to send message to other asylum seekers, people who are trying to seek safety and security in the UK. But it is the wrong way. It is breaking the law to make a point. It's not the right way, and it isn't working at all. It isn't working, hence someone needs to be accountable, and the Home Secretary should actually consider her position.
The ruling by the High Court will be a vindication for lawyers, rights groups and activists alike, who for too long have had their concerns regarding Napier Barracks ignored. But they will still feel their fight is far from over, while asylum seekers still remain housed there in what the court described as appalling conditions. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Amnesty International decried the inadequacy of wealthy nations' climate action plans as a human rights failure and delivered a blueprint for policymakers to urgently change course to avert impending catastrophe and uphold their international obligations. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanus Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Amnesty Says Paltry G7 Climate Plans, a Devastating Mass-Scale Assault on Human Rights. Stay tuned for the details. Amnesty International decried the inadequacy of wealthy nations' climate action plans as a human rights failure and delivered a blueprint for policymakers to urgently change course to avert impending catastrophe and uphold their international obligations. The unambiguous climate plans submitted by G7 members represent a violation of the human rights of billions of people. These are not administrative failures. They are a devastating mass-scale assault on human rights, said Chiara Liguori, Amnesty International Human Rights and Environment Policy Advisor, in a statement recently. Ligori's stern assessment came alongside the release of Stop Burning Our Rights, a new policy brief from the organization that calls the climate emergency a human rights crisis of unprecedented proportions and mainstream of deep-rooted injustices. Looking through lens of government's human rights obligations, the paper says that wealthier nations who disproportionately fuel the climate crisis must be at the forefront of climate action to reach net zero emission. Criticizing targets of net zero by 2050 as too little too late, the policy brief further calls on wealthy nations to take greater action to finance developing countries' climate target through grants, not loans, and fund remedies for climate harms that have already happened. The devastating impacts from climate crisis-fueled extreme weather events are already clear, and global governments committed to a goal of keeping global warming within 1.5 degrees compared to pre-industrial levels, Amnesty says. Carbon emissions from fossil fuels rose 1% annually between 2010 and 2018, the report adds, and while the coronavirus pandemic triggered a downward blip in emissions, the IEA projected a rise of 4.8% in 2021. What's more, some governments have pandemic money given with no strings attached to fossil fuel companies. And yet, many governments, though their climate plans, are putting human rights, including the rights to life, water, food, housing, health, and a healthy environment and self-determination, at huge risk, the publication says. While a slew of new 2030 and carbon neutrality targets have recently been announced, most countries, especially wealthier states that are members of the G20, are currently failing to adopt sufficiently ambitious and human rights consistent climate plans that would contribute to avoiding the worst human rights impacts of climate change, the paper states. Failure to take necessary steps to rein in the global crisis and mitigate its harms amounts to a human rights violation and should be condemned as with other human rights violations, according to the group. Such violations, the report argues, condemn millions of people to premature death, hunger, diseases, displacement, not just in the future but also at present. They contribute to conflicts and to the unfolding cycle of human rights violations. They perpetuate and accelerate current inequalities and discrimination against those who are already being oppressed by systematic injustices. Failure to adequately tackle the climate crisis is a form of discrimination. The paper lays out a number of recommendations to keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and support human rights obligations. They include that governments revise their national climate plans, immediately stop to fossil fuel expansion, overhaul food systems such that unsustainable and exploitative systems are left behind in favor of ones that promote human rights and sustainable systems. Enact policies to end the deforestation by 2030, end subsidies of fossil fuels as well as those for forest biomass and crop-based biofuels, and implement climate action-centered COVID-19 recovery plans. Wealthy nations must also commit to stopping fossil fuel expansion in other countries, lest they simply shift where the polluting extraction and refining operations occur. Simply put, states that are failing to phase out fossil fuels in a timeline aligned with the 1.5 degrees Celsius imperative with their respective capabilities are violating human rights. The paper adds that corporations and their financial backers that fail to shift from fossil fuel operations must be held accountable for their human rights abuses. The demands were delivered a day before NOAA and Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, announced that the monthly average of CO2 levels in May hit 419 parts per million, the highest level since measurements began over six decades ago. The paper also came just ahead of the G7 Leaders Summit, which begins in the UK and where, according to Amnesty's Liguori, leaders must commit to urgent climate action. The G7 and other wealthy industrialized countries have historically emitted the most carbon and bear the greatest responsibility for the current climate crisis. They also have the most resources to tackle it, she said. But their strategies to date have been woefully inadequate, and their support for their countries have been stingy. At the G7 Leaders Summit, governments must commit to unconditionally phasing out all fossil fuels as close to 2030 as is technically feasible. They must put in place tough regulations requiring businesses to shift to renewable energy and stop using taxes to subsidize the deadly fossil fuel industry, she said.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrou Sajafi. A new report by the United Nations Human Rights Council spotlights growing Islamophobia and excessive surveillance of Muslims in countries around the world, urging the countries to do more to combat Islamophobia. A report by the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding finds that American Muslims are the most likely faith group to report facing religious discrimination at about 60% over the past 5 years. Now, two recent incidents in Canada and Austria shed more light on the rising Islamophobia. In the Canadian city of London, a driver slammed his car into a Muslim family, killing four people. And last month in Austria, the government released a controversial national map of Islam and placed signs across the country warning of nearby mosques that may constitute a threat. Now, following the release of the map, attacks against Muslims have increased in Austria rapidly. And tonight's debate show, we'll be discussing with our panelists the reasons for the rise of Islamophobia. Now, without much further ado, let's get right to business. So let's invite our guest. We have founder of the initiative by Austrian Muslims, Tarafa Bagajati in Vienna, and also director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, is joining us from Tirana. Good to have you both on the show. Now, starting with Tarafa, the Vienna government's recent steps to contain so-called political Islam have put 800,000 Muslims in danger by triggering new violence on Austria's Muslim minority. You know, mosques on government maps signify threat, and this has dramatically raised racist attacks in Austria last month. What has caused this to happen in that country?
The problem is in Austria, especially, and also in the Western countries, that the Islamophobic, the former racism against Muslim, is going to be within the raising of right extremism and right-wing parties, a political program having more voices from the people in the election. And this is a very dangerous dimension, what we are facing today as European Muslims. And this land card what we had, this Islam card from our government, was a very problematic indication, actually, against the Muslim community, giving the whole community under pressure, under observation, and also under mistrust of the whole community. And this is directly against the social cohesion in the country, and also against the traditional Austrian way dealing with Islam, which is based on dialogue and respecting each other's.
Okay, now, Zafar Bangash, let's take a look at Canada now. That's where you live. Apart from this recent Ontario hate crime, 4 years ago we also had a 27-year-old white supremacist bursting into Quebec City mosque, gunning down six worshippers there, wounding some other people. So what's behind such crimes against Muslim community in Canada?
Well, in Canada, there is a large body of opinion that exists on the social media. And they propagate all kinds of hatred against Muslims in particular, because it also fits into over the last 20 or so years since the attacks of 9/11, when Muslim countries were targeted and bombed and destroyed. And so these right-wing groups in Canada, and indeed in the United States, and now of course this has become a global phenomenon, because all of these internet or social media platforms are interlinked with each other, and they radicalize people, particularly youth, in spreading hatred against the Muslims. So these attacks that we have witnessed 2 days ago or 3 days ago in London, Ontario, a small sleepy town where a family of five were mowed down by a pickup truck. Four of them were killed, crushed under the truck, and one young child or young boy, 9-year-old, survived with serious injuries. It was the latest incident. But last year, a Muslim sitting outside a mosque in one of the suburbs of Toronto was actually killed by a white man who was wielding a knife. He came and he just slit his throat and killed him right outside the mosque. And as you mentioned, in January of 2017, the university student went with a gun, not one, but several guns, and he shot and killed six people while they were praying, and 20 others that were seriously injured. One of them, of course, is still in wheelchair, incapacitated from the waist down. So you see that this kind of hatred is actually generated on social media platforms, and regrettably, the political leadership in Canada, apart from spouting various slogans, have not taken any practical steps to confront this kind of Islamophobia. Of course, it's not as bad as it is in Europe, where governments have actually openly come out against Muslims, as the other guest pointed out, in Austria. The same situation in France and Germany, Britain, etc.
Right.
In Canada, it is slightly better, but regrettably, there are no laws to confront Islamophobia and hatred against the Muslims.
Okay. So we talked about Austria and Canada. Let's go to the U.S. Between 2015, Tarafa, and 2019, there was a spike in hateful incidents against Muslims in the United States. More than 1,000 cases were reported by the media, ranging from harassment and violence to federal policies against Muslim communities. Let's now explore the root cause of Islamophobia in the United States.
Could you please also just condolate and send our sincere condolences for this family and Pakistani community, and also whole Muslim community in Canada, and also consider such attacks not just against the Muslim community, they are against the whole society, the social cohesion in the whole country, in the Western country, but also in the world, and also against humanity. The problem is when we are not taking in consideration the anti-Islamic rhetoric as an Islamophobic act, when we are just taking this as a normal hatred or a normal racism or whatever without naming it, we do not develop a strategy against this. And this is our mission and also our message for our politicians, our journalists, our media, and also academics and the civil society to take this phenomena of Islamophobia, in German we call it Islamfeindlichkeit, as a racism like antisemitism against the Jews. And we have to develop mechanism against that. And we are saying this, that the rhetoric of having just populist rhetoric in elections and whatever are leading for attacks, for a physical attacks, and also in the worst case for killing people like today in Canada and like 2009 as an example with Marwa Sherbini, the Egyptian girl or lady on Dresden in Germany. That time, the German governments took more than 1 week till they named it as Islamophobic attack. And we are welcome and also appreciate that today in Canada, Mr. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his officials directly and very soon said this is Islamophobic attack and also this is a terrorism. And right. This is very important, also a message for our young people in the society. There is people, there is governments, there is laws who is protecting you from any hatred.
Okay. Now, Zafar, mainstream media, like social media at times, they have kept silent on hate crimes committed against Muslims in different parts of the world. Why is that?
Well, basically, the mainstream media take their direction from their politicians. And I'd like to bring in here the atmosphere that exists in the United States, and in particular, as I mentioned earlier on, since 9/11, but even more particularly when Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, and he became the president at the beginning of 2017. So his incendiary rhetoric actually fueled the media in the United States. And so the media was basically taking that position. Even here in the case of this horrific attack in London, Ontario, although the police called it a possible hate crime and a crime based on hatred of this family's religion, Canadian politicians have called it a hate crime and Islamophobia. Yet the main Canadian TV channel, CBC, simply referred to as an incident. Now, one can begin to see that, you know, they are soft peddling this whole issue. Even while the police are saying that this is probably motivated by hatred of Muslims. So what we really have to do, and this is a challenge for the Muslim community here in Canada, that we have to force the politicians to declare Islamophobia as a hate crime in law, not simply by rhetoric, but in law. And of course, the media would then be forced to accept it and report it accordingly. Otherwise, regrettably, at the present time, the media is simply brushing aside these things and just ignore them largely. And I'm afraid that even this incident would be forgotten after a few days.
Right. Now, Taref, Zafar Bangash made mention of the U.S. government's role and also media workings regarding this. Now, you tell us about the role that the governments are playing in fomenting Islamophobia in different parts of the world.
This is, of course, one of the great problems if you have an institutional Islamophobia, forbidding headscarf, having the whole community under observation, and this would lead the media and all others to have these steps. But also, as an example from Austria, I'm glad to tell you that, as an example with this Islam Karte, Islam map, a lot of voices were against the government. Even the Green Party, which is in the coalition of the government, was against this. The churches, the Jewish rabbis, the students, and the intellectual were against that. That means our our mission to make as a coalition partner as possible against all kinds of racism, especially against Islamophobia, and name it and clarify it and document it. As an example, till now, we are urging our members, we are urging our Muslim community to report those accidents. And till now, there is a lot of people who are attacked and do not report it. If you do not report anything, it does not simply exist in the statistic. And those messages as an essential part of the society, this would develop the better existing of the Muslim community in Europe as a part of this society.
Zafar Bangash, a basic question. Where and when did this all start? I mean, where can we explore the origins of Islamophobia?
Well, Islamophobia is actually has a very, very long history. It goes all the way back to the emergence of Islam and the reaction of both the Christians and the Jewish communities to Islam at that time. But in more particular sort of reference, I think we would have to go back to the time of the Crusades, when in fact Muslims were still quite in the ascendancy, and that is where this hatred of Islam and Muslims began. And so Islamophobia is nothing new. It simply becomes dormant slightly, but if there is a feeling within the Western world that Muslims are beginning to rise up again, then this aspect of Islamophobia comes to the fore. In their minds, in the minds of Western intellectuals, Islam is a threat to them because Muslims continue to remain faithful to their basic tenets of the religion. So Muslims refuse to accept the so-called vulgar values that the West propagates. Muslim women, by and large, still wear the hijab. And so the Western intellectuals see this as a threat to their secular way of life, because their position is that they must dominate and control everything. They must control everybody's thinking and lives and so on. And Muslims obviously do not fall under that. They refuse to submit, and that is something that they are afraid of, and that's why we see this Islamophobic eruptions taking place.
Okay, Tarafa, you're going to comment on that?
I just want to emphasize one point, that this is two concepts of the Western discussion, and we cannot say these Western intellectuals, all of them. There is the concept of identifying yourself, excluding the other, and the other concept is identifying the country, including the others. And the others are we, are Jews, are Roma and Sinti, are migrants, are everybody else who are building this community. And I think that we have partners on intellectual way, but also we Muslim community not yet have our place in the intellectual, political, economical, educational procedure in the country. Okay. And this is our challenge for the last years. I tell you an example. Till the 80s, till the 90s, there were racism against all foreigners. And nobody were against headscarf. But right. Now, because that time, the headscarf women were just the cleaning ladies. You don't find them anywhere. But now we had ladies, Muslim ladies with headscarf as a teacher, as a doctor, as a professor, as a driver on the street. And this make some people who are fearing from losing their identity, as they think, from the Muslim. Right. And now our message is having this multiple identity in the society, our place are making your place even better, and not you don't need to be any fear. But the racist people, this man who killed the people today, I do not think that he was afraid from the Muslims. There is an aggressive racism which is not, which do not need, does not need any fear to deal.
Okay. Now, Zafar, there is a civil rights group suing Facebook over the company's failure to stop hate speech against Muslims, and that is believed to be in violation of consumer protection laws. Why should Facebook do such a thing? You know, so social media is not always helping the truth out, like in the case of Palestinians and during this recent Gaza escalation.
You see, regrettably, all of these platforms that exist there, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc., they also have an agenda. And they target and block those opinions that seem to run counter to what they perceive to be their interests. You gave the example of the Palestinians. It's a very good example. It's very illustrative that Facebook, they set up certain algorithms whereby any comments that are favorable to the Palestinians are not only pushed down, but any anti-Palestinian comments are brought up. And even if they are not, even after that, if they are not successful, then they simply shut them down completely. So it should be clear that whatever media platforms we are talking about, they basically take their direction from their governments. And regrettably today, in the Western world, the overwhelming majority of the governments in the Western world, and this is particularly true in Europe, but also in the United States, these governments are extremely Islamophobic. I know, and I must admit, that Canada does not fall under that category, but again, I would say that the Canadian government has not taken the practical steps beyond the rhetoric to institute laws that would make Islamophobia a hate crime. Only then would this menace be addressed. So the point that you mentioned about social media platforms, they take their direction basically from the policies of their governments.
Okay, Tarifa, we have only 30 seconds. If you could tell us what can be done in order to remove this misunderstanding and to get the facts out about Islam, to tackle Islamophobia. 30 seconds only.
For example, in this solidarity with the Palestinian, which make the whole politician and the whole world surprised how energy they have against those against the Israeli government in this sense, and also for solidarity with the Palestinian.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this debate. You're on Press TV. Thank you, my guest, founder of the initiative by Austrian Muslims, Tarifa Baghajati in Vienna. We also have director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, in Tirana. And that's it for this debate. I've been your host.